Confretos, and welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And isn't it the truth that we certainly all go through so many ups and downs in our lives, and there is no one, none of us, are immune from life's challenges. And wouldn't it have been terrific if the mass shooter Patrick Crucius, who's 21 years old from Allen, Texas, and Connor Stephen Betts, who was 24 years old and lived in the Dayton suburb of Bellbrook, had been able to reach out and ask for help. And I'm going to go through a really in-depth psychological analysis of these two young men. I've done a lot of research in the last day and a half, you know, looking for clues. And with both of these young men, there were red flags a long time ago. And, you know, one of the things that I've been talking about here on the Ask Beattie Show for the last several years is that typically people, we wait too long to ask for help, whether or not we're talking about depression or anxiety. I mean, look at, here we have in the United States, there's 16 million adults in the United States, and that translates into one in five Americans who've been diagnosed with depression. And I suspect that number is probably very, very low. 40 million adults, according to research, are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. But what I have found in the past 35 years, I can hardly believe it is 35 years that I've been practicing as a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, nobody ever calls unless there is a crisis. No one calls me and says, Beattie, I need to improve my communication or problem solving skills. People wait, and I think that people wait much too long. I suspect that there's still a lot of stigma around mental illness and mental health and asking for help. And this is really, I remember when I was talking with Gary Null before I began the Ask Beattie Show, and what my goal was and has been, and today I believe is show 269, so it's been a few years now, is that I was hoping that there would be something every single week that I might say that would help to motivate and inspire people to reach out and ask for help when things were not going well. And naturally, we all have sadness, and sadness is normal, and not everybody in the world needs to be in therapy or counseling. And we also know about the incredible overprescription of psychiatric medications in this country. But the fact is that people are having a really, really difficult time now, which of course is exacerbated that everything is going, that's been going on politically, with economic inequality and racism and poverty and the consequences of climate change. I see people who are just normally going about their business. They're angry, they're uptight, they're worried, and for all the right reasons. So if you're finding, and it doesn't have to be a commitment to therapy for life or anything like that, but if you're finding that you're really having some understandable challenges, whether it is with depression or anxiety, or you find that you're drinking too much, or you're just popping too many pills, and you're having problems sleeping, and you're not exactly sure why, and you've gone to the doctor, and the doctor has said, look, physically everything is okay, and you're looking at your nutrition, and you're doing everything that you think you really need to do to really improve the mind-body connection. But if you're finding that even though you feel that you are on the right path, that you're still just not feeling well, perhaps it's with your relationship or your sex life, or you're just, you know, off track, you have to be able to give yourself permission and reach out and at least get a second opinion, another perspective on something that you might be able to do to improve the quality of your life and your relationship. And of course, it's important to look at your diet, and we should all be on plant-based diets and consuming fruits and vegetables and grains and fish and nuts and supplements, and of course, exercise. And for me, exercise has really been a savior. I've been a competitive tennis player for most of my life, and exercise and weight training and tennis, it's really made a very, very big difference in my own life to help me de-stress. And of course, having supportive people in our life and eliminating toxins. And of course, when we talk about toxins, most people think about chemical toxins. Well, when I talk about toxins, I of course include chemical toxins, but I also include toxic people who will kill us one way or another if we allow and enable them to be in our life, and that includes friends and family. And I'm not suggesting that you just eliminate people, but after a period of time when you've been trying to acknowledge and address and resolve and have conversations with people, and if it is simply not happening, and the people that you are surrounding yourself with, whether or not it's your bosses or your colleagues or your friends or your family, are really, really unsupportive and they really upset you to a great degree. I mean, why do we want to be upset at all when we're around people? You really do have to give yourself permission to set the boundaries and, if need be, end relationships. And, of course, things like positive visualization and dancing all help to really, really give us some joy in our life. Eliminating sugars and sodas and alcohol and nicotine. So these are all the things that we really need to do. And, you know, after every session that I have with my patients in my private practice here in New York City and in East Hampton, I ask them to consider two things. And one, as they are just leaving the office, is to have them really be mindful and monitor whether or not, when they navigate their days, whether or not they are doing things that are really in their best interest. And it's amazing when we are mindful about what we are doing and what we are not doing, we may find that a lot of the behaviors and a lot of the activities and a lot of the interactions that we are having are not in our best interest. And of course, the goal is to be aware and then give ourselves permission and empower ourselves with the ability to change course. And none of this is easy, but you know, every day is a new day, and today is a new day for you. So I'm suggesting that you follow this assignment, and you may have some surprises. You may find that you are engaging in behaviors and activities and in interactions with people that you're finding are really, really not in your best interest. And of course, the goal is to make some changes as soon as possible. And if you need a little bit of help, as the Beatles suggest, give yourself permission to reach out and get some help. It can be some short-term help that can really, really make a terrific difference in your life. But I think that we need to look at what's happened in the last couple of days. I mean, look, we've had two mass shootings in the United States, leaving at least 29 dead and 53 injured in less than a day. And Sunday was the 216th day of the year with already 251 mass shootings in the United States. And if you recall, Both attacks follow a week which Gilroy, California, Brooklyn, New York, and Philadelphia were struck by gun violence. And for those of you who may not know, a mass shooting is actually defined as any incident in which at least four people were shot, excluding the gunman. So here we have two people killed in massive shootings in, 21 people. Two people would have been two people too many, but 21 people were killed in massive shootings in El Paso. 26 were wounded. And here we have another hate crime. And, you know, when I was doing the research and reading the New York Times and reading the news reports, here we have a Hispanic invasion. Who does that sound like? You know, when I listen to Fox News and to President Trump, who ignites the hate, talking about Mexicans are rapists and drug dealers. And what he does is that he rouses his base with fear and hate, and certainly I would imagine on some level might begin to realize his impact, his responsibility in what is going on in this country, of course, including putting families and children in cages on the border. So here we have the Hispanic invasion, and this was a manifesto of hate that was on the internet minutes before the attack. So Patrick Crucius, 21, from Allen, Texas, which happens to be an upper middle class suburban neighborhood. He was described as a loner, and he lives with his grandparents, and I'm going to go into his psychological profile in a lot of detail. And then, not even 24 hours later, we have another mass shooting in Dayton, Ohio, at 1 a.m. Sunday morning, killing 10, 27 wounded in a popular nightclub area, the Oregon District area. So who was this gunman? Well, he was a white male, another white male. It's like, what is going on with white males in this country? In his early 20s, outfitted. Now listen to this. Talk about a plan. Outfitted in body armor and carried an assault rifle. How and where did he manage to purchase an assault rifle? And wait till you hear about his psychological and psychiatric profile. And multiple high-capacity magazines was shot and killed by uniformed police officers in less than a minute after he opened fire. So who was this man? Well, Connor Stephen Betts, 24 years old, lived in the Dayton suburb of Bellbrook. And interestingly, but not really so interestingly or surprisingly, police had no previous contact with Betts, although when I was going through some of the research online just before coming to the Progressive Radio Network studio, I found out, in fact, that the police did have previous serious contact with Betts, and I'm going to tell you about some history about both of these young men. So he killed 9 people and injured 27, and in the midst of the attack, his own sister Megan, who was 22 years old, was also killed in the attack. So, what is it about young men who are so full of anger and hate? So here we have from New Zealand to Pittsburgh to a synagogue in Poway, California, we have aggrieved white men have turned to mass murder. And questions that we really, really have to ask. Where does their deep-seated anger come from? And of course, wearing my psychotherapist hat, we need to explore the family and the friends, or the lack of, and the school records, or mental illness. And these are things that we really, really do need to look at over and above systemic problems, systemic political problems like economic inequality and racism and poverty and climate change and white nationalism. We have to look at these issues in a very, very systemic kind of a way. Otherwise, we are going to continue to miss the boat. Now, there was a piece yesterday in the LA Times, and this was an opinion piece. The headline, "We have studied every mass shooting since 1966, and here's what we've learned about the shooters." And this piece is by Jillian Peterson. In fact, she just sent me an email, and I was hoping to be able to interview her on the show today. But she said that she's, of course, bombarded with all kinds of news requests. And I'm hoping maybe in the next couple of weeks we are going to be able to talk. And James Densley. So Jillian Peterson happens to be a psychologist and professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University. And James Densley is a sociologist and also a professor of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University. And together they run the Violence Project. So listen to what they have found in looking at mass shootings since 1966. So they say that in the last week, more than 30 people have died in three separate mass shootings in Gilroy, El Paso, and Dayton, Ohio. We believe, they say, that analyzing and understanding data about who commits such massacres can help prevent more lives being lost. Correct. So for 2 years, they've been studying the life histories of mass shooters in the United States for a project funded by the National Institute of Justice, which is the research arm of the U.S. Department of Justice. They built a database dating back to 1966 of every single mass shooter who shot and killed four more people in public place, an ever shooting incident at schools, workplaces, and places of worship since 1999. They have interviewed incarcerated people and their families, shooting survivors, and first responders. They have read media and social media, manifestos, suicide notes, trial transcripts, and medical records. And their goal has been to find new data-driven pathways for preventing such shootings. Of course, that is what it really needs to be all about, which is prevention. And although they haven't found that mass shooters are all alike, their data do reveal four commonalities. And I'm really, really curious to hear what you think about these four commonalities among the perpetrators of nearly all the mass shootings that they studied. So number one, and not to be surprised by this first finding. First, the vast majority of mass shooters in their study experienced early childhood trauma and exposure to violence at a very, very young age. The nature of their exposure included parental suicide, physical or sexual abuse, neglect, domestic violence, and or severe bullying. And the trauma was often a precursor to mental health concerns, including depression, anxiety, thought disorders, or suicidality. So that's number one. Second, practically every mass shooter that they studied had reached an identifiable crisis point in the weeks or months leading up to the shooting. They often had become angry and despondent because of a specific grievance. For workplace shooters, a change in job status was frequently the trigger. And for shooters in other contexts, relationship rejection or loss often played a role. Such crises were in many cases communicated to others through a marked change in behavior, an expression of suicidal thoughts or plans, or specific threats of violence. Now, I'm not talking about policing people, but certainly in the school system, you know, we really have an opportunity, teachers and guidance counselors and psychologists in the elementary and middle school and high school, to really be able to make a huge, huge difference in children's lives and in their families' lives by early identification and early intervention. Third, most of the shooters had studied the actions of other shooters, and they sought validation for their motives. So people in crisis have always existed, but in the age of 24-hour rolling news and social media, there are actually scripts to follow that promise notoriety in death. Look at me, look at me. Perhaps in their day-to-day life, nobody looked at them. And when we go through the psychological profile of both Patrick Crucius and also Connor Stephen Betts, you're going to see that a lot of this, most of this, really resonates with what happened or what did not happen in these young men's lives. So they're looking. There's a promise for notoriety in death. So societal fear and fascination with mass shootings partly drives the motivation to commit them. And I have to say that Fox News and Trump, they continue to ignite the hate, and continue to rouse their base with fear and hate on an ongoing basis. I mean, can you imagine the president of the United States, you know, to be making statements that Mexicans are rapists and drug dealers, and they are taking away our jobs and they are replacing us. And you have a lot of people who are in a bad, bad place. And maybe this is what they learned in their own family of origins. And they're listening. They're listening to the leader of our country espousing all of this hate with their own upset and their own depression and their own issues. People are just, they are ripe. Now, of course, not all people who grow up in traumatic family situations, you know, and in fact, it's a very, very small minority. But here we have that in the last week, that mass shootings do tend to come in clusters. They are, according to these researchers, they are socially contagious. Perpetrators, they actually study other perpetrators and model their acts after previous shootings. And many are radicalized online in their search for validation from others that their will to murder is justified. So people are looking for validation. They are looking for respect. They are looking for connection. And when they are not getting it in their own lives, they are oftentimes prone to really go off track. And talk about off track, what happened with these two shootings and with these two young men. Now, fourth, the shooters all had the means to carry out their plans. So once someone decides that life is no longer worth living and that murdering others would be a proper revenge only means an opportunity stand in the way of another mass shooting. So is an appropriate shooting site accessible? Can the would-be shooter obtain firearms? Like, I am so curious, and I think we're going to find this out as we move along. How Connor Stephen Betts was able to get the guns and to be able to buy an assault rifle. And when I tell you about his history, you are going to be enraged that there was no record, that there was no way to have been able to have the person who sold him the gun to be able to check to see that he was a very, very disturbed young man who had some serious, serious dealings with the police. So other data that the researchers found was that in 80% of school shootings, perpetrators got their weapons from family members. That is so, so interesting. And that workplace shooters tended to use handguns that they legally owned. Other public shooters were more likely to acquire them illegally. So the researchers, of course, are now asking the most important question. So what do these commonalities tell us about how to prevent future shootings? So what they say is one step needs to be depriving potential shooters of the means to carry out their plans. And of course, President Trump, he doesn't talk about the importance of gun control. You know, he is too tied into the NRA, at least today. He did happen to denounce white nationalism, and that has been his party platform, actually, right from the beginning. Not to denounce white nationalism, but to continue to run his base with the fears and the need to perpetuate the myth that immigrants in our country, that blacks and Hispanics are taking over our world, and that we need to do something to stop, that we need to do something to stop people from taking away our jobs and our monies and our opportunities. And this is what white nationalism is really all about. So yes, depriving potential shooters of the means to carry out their plans. Potential shooting sites can be made less accessible with visible security measures such as metal detectors and police officers. Well, here we go with more policing, and how many metal detectors can we have? You know, I was saying to my husband Jim yesterday that, you know, I'm kind of getting used to the fact that almost everywhere I go, somebody's looking in my purse, somebody's looking in my wallet, they want to see identification. I'm starting to feel like I'm really living in a police state. And weapons need to be better controlled through age restrictions, permit to purchase licensing, universal background checks, yes, safe storage campaigns, and red flag laws. And those are measures that help control firearm access for vulnerable individuals or people in crisis. Another step, according to these researchers, is to try to make it more difficult for potential perpetrators to find validation for their planned action. Well, that is certainly a challenge, because media campaigns like Notoriety are helping star perpetrators of the oxygen of publicity, and technology companies are increasingly being held accountable for facilitating mass violence. But we all can slow the spread of mass shootings by changing how we consume, produce, and distribute violent content on media and social media. don't like or share violent content. Don't read or share killers' manifestos. I mean, how do we control that? People go on the internet. They can read whatever they want. They can download whatever they want. And we also need to study our current approaches. For example, do lockdown and active shooter drills help children prepare for the worst, or hand potential shooters the script for mass violence? There's so many questions. We do not have a lot of the answers yet at this point. We also need to, as a society, be more proactive. Most mass public shooters are suicidal, and their cries and crises are often well known to others before the shooting occurs. The vast majority of mass shooters leak their plans ahead of time. And they probably leak their plans ahead of time. And just like with people who are talking about other kinds of suicide, maybe hoping that somebody is going to care enough and somebody is going to intervene before it's too late. Because people who see or sense that something is wrong, however, may not always say something to someone owing to the absence of clear reporting protocols or fear of overreaction and unduly labeling a person as a potential threat. I've always found that I would rather err on the side of caution. Proactive violence prevention starts with schools, colleges, churches, and employers initiating conversations about mental health and establishing systems for identifying individuals in crisis, reporting concerns, and reaching out, not with punitive measures, but with resources and long-term intervention. I think that everybody should be trained in some fashion to recognize the signs of a crisis. But I really want to talk about the psychological profiles of these two young men. And I want to begin with Connor Stephen Betts, 24, who lived in the Dayton suburb of Bellbrook. And according to initial reports, which proved to be false, the initial reports said that the police had no previous contact with him. But that was not true. He killed 9 people and he injured 27. So in doing my research for the show, this is what I discovered from a variety of different news outlets. And according to classmates who spent time with him in high school, this is what they had to say. And these people's statements have been vetted. And we missed the boat big time when it came to intervention with not just intervention, but some serious, serious intervention with Connor Stephen Betts and his family. So apparently, he had an enormous problem with rage. Believe it or not, and this was in high school, he had a rape list and a kill list. Okay? Trouble in his past. He was bullied in high school, and he had a plan, which he talked about a lot, to shoot up the high school. Pretty, pretty serious stuff. He was suspended for actually compiling a hit list of those he wanted to kill. And this was in high school. And a rape list of girls he wanted to sexually assault. So that followed an earlier suspension after Betts came to school. Can you imagine coming to school in high school with a list of women that he wanted to sexually assault? And I am so curious, and I'm not pointing fingers, and I'm not going to blame. But what did the school personnel do about this? other than suspend him for a short period of time. So the hit list in early 2012, it sparked a police investigation. So that was a really good thing. And one third of Bellbrook students, they skipped school out of fear that Connor Stephen Betts was a danger and might hurt them. There were red flags that were raised years and years and years ago. And apparently there was an incident in high school with Betts that should have prevented him from ever being able to get a gun. And again, we're going to be finding more and more and more about his family, which neighbors described as being a glowing, lovely, wonderful family. And maybe they were a glowing, lovely, wonderful family, but certainly people really, really missed the boat big time when it came to really looking the other way. Now, whether he had counseling or not had counseling, I mean, we're going to be finding out a lot more about this. And as far as his work history went, he worked at Chipotle, the Mexican Grill, and at a gas station in Centerville, Ohio. But when you look at what went on with his rape list and his kill list, I mean, here was a very, very, very troubled boy. And, you know, one of the things that I am so proud of, and I wish there was a way that we could design and implement this type of a program in all schools in the United States, beginning at the elementary school level. You know, for those of you who've been listening to me for the last few years, you know that I'm Canadian. Of course, I have dual citizenship, but that I was one of the directors of the school social services program for the Montreal School Board. And I was responsible for a large staff and hundreds of schools. And the way it worked in those years is if there were any concerns, whether it was from the teacher or the gym teacher or anybody in the school, if a child was acting out or was too quiet or was bullied, or if there was some trauma, or if we had heard of some crisis that was going on in the child's life, or the child was not performing well, or was failing school, or was quiet, or was too quiet, or was sleeping in class, that there was a referral process that we developed where the child would be seen by a school social worker. Perhaps there was a need for testing by the school psychologist. Perhaps there was a need for the child to see the school nurse. Perhaps there was a need, because there are only certain resources within the school system, that the child and the family be referred to an outside counseling resource or medical resource. So that in those days, we found that no child was really left behind. If we had concerns, we stepped in. And I actually began, after my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill as a school social worker, I routinely made home visits. I wanted to know what was going on with the family. I mean, after all, if a child is not performing in school, or if a child is too quiet, or if a child is too aggressive, or if a child has a plan to hurt himself or somebody else, there is a need to intervene. It's not about policing. It is not about looking at people as if everybody in the world needs to have mental health counseling. But it is the responsible thing to do when we are able to see that there are symptoms that actually need to be looked into. And here we have with, you know, Connor Stephen Betts. I mean, clearly there were so many red flags. And when the police actually investigated what was going on in 2012, I am so curious to find out, with everything that was happening with the rape list and the kill list and the suspensions and the fact that other students were really afraid of him, what the upshot was of the police investigation and how he was able to purchase the assault rifle, because apparently one of his classmates said that there was an incident in high school with Betts that should have prevented him from ever getting a gun. And I wonder where the documentation was. And again, so curious about the family dynamics and, you know, what the parents did. You know, there were problems in school. The school suspended him a couple of times. Was there a plan? Did anything happen as a result of the suspensions or the rape lists or the kill lists? But I think that as we go along, we're certainly going to be, you know, hopefully finding out much more detail about these young men. And then if we're looking at Patrick Crucius, now he is the suspect in the El Paso massacre. What we found, and this was in the Los Angeles Times, that he was very, very much a loner. And look at what he posted. The suspect he posted in the killing of at least 20 people in El Paso, he posted an online manifesto before starting on the deadly rampage that was described by Texas law enforcement and political leaders as hate filled and racist. So they identified him. As well, we know he was the 21-year-old. He is the 21-year-old young man is the suspect at the Walmart in the border city. And although authorities did not publicly confirm his identity or describe the precise contents of the manifesto, a document posted on the website 8chan, which I've never heard about, of course, about an hour and a half before the rampage, spoke about the invasion of Latino immigrants. Of course, we hear that on Fox. We hear that from our president, and said the writer agreed with the shooter who killed worshipers at a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand. That document was posted by an anonymous user who posted another document under the file name P. Crucius. So, what did we learn about him when he was in high school? So, here we go. In 2017, he started to attend Collin College, which is a community college in McKinney, Texas. A former neighbor said that Crucius was an extreme loner who always sat alone on the bus in junior high and high school. He spoke negatively of other kids who played sports or joined the school band. Another person described him as very much a loner, very standoffish. He was having a really tough time during those years, and someone who didn't interact with a whole lot of people. Apparently, a friend of his said that he only walked ahead or behind them, never interacting and always keeping to himself. He liked animals and kept pet snakes. He wouldn't talk to people. No one really knew him. Another former classmate said that he was very strong-minded in class and would try to take charge, but other kids refused to work with him because he was irritable and had a short temper. He was apparently often picked on because of how he spoke and because he wore what looked like hand-me-down clothes. Another former classmate said that he was in English class with Crucius during their senior year, and the taunts from other kids during class seemed relentless. Every time this man said that he looked up in class, it was someone new speaking negatively to the kid. That Patrick is dumb, that Patrick is stupid. So here you have a young man who was obviously in an incredible amount of pain. I read that he was living with his grandparents, so we're going to hopefully find out what was going on in the home. We'll hopefully also find out where his biological parents were. But here again, we have a kid who was experiencing an enormous amount of pain, an enormous amount of disrespect, an enormous amount of troubles. And I want to know, again, it's not about blaming anybody. I want to know whether or not there was anybody who took responsibility to refer these two young men for much, much needed mental health counseling. You know, it's very easy to just look the other way. And, you know, with both of these young men, there was an enormous amount of pain that they were really experiencing. There was pain. There was anger. Certainly in the case, as his classmates described Patrick Crucius, there was an enormous amount of disrespect. And you know what happens? As the years go by, and when people are not helped and encouraged to express their pain and their anger and their upset and their disappointments and their feelings of rejection, the pot at some point is going to boil over in one way or another. And of course, again, it's the vast, vast, vast minority of people who commit these kinds of, of crimes. But what can we do? We need to do a much, much better job and pay attention to the children. And I still say that the schools, I mean, we see the children in schools oftentimes more than the parents do, especially parents where you have both parents working and people are busy. And I think that it is incumbent upon the school administration to be able to really take a look at what is going on with these kids emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically. And we're not talking about that everybody should be in therapy and that everybody has a mental health problem. But the kids are exhibiting, they're exhibiting certain kinds of behavior that as professionals, we really do need to pay attention to. Because again, with these two boys, it was not just that this was a surprise. It is a surprise, of course, that, you know, they went to the lengths that they did. But it is not a surprise that these two young men were full of hate and full of rage and full of anger. And of course, if they were listening to Fox, and if they were listening to their president continually talking about immigrants and Mexicans and that they're rapists and drug dealers and that we have all these people that are coming to the country and taking over our lives and our jobs, all of their feelings were ignited day in and day out. And of course, if they were on the computer and they were reading and they were a part of a little group or forum that was always and continuing to talk about white nationalism and to talk about terrorism, we should not be at all surprised about what happened. You know, an investigation by the New York Times earlier this year found that at least a third of white extremist killers since 2011 were inspired by others who perpetuated similar attacks, professed a reverence for them, or showed an interest in their tactics. So white supremacy, in other words, is a violent, interconnected, transnational ideology. Its adherents are gathering in anonymous online forums. And I understand that these forums are continuing to really expand, to spread their ideas, to spread their hate, plotting attacks and cheering on acts of terrorism. So here you have these two young men. They didn't fit in anywhere. So all of a sudden, they are online. They are a part of a group. They now have camaraderie. And it makes a lot of sense how and why they became involved in these acts of terrorism. And according to the New York Times, the law enforcement currently offers few answers as to how to contain these online communities. The anonymous nature of the forum makes it difficult to track down the validity of the threats, and trolls frequently muddy the waters by attempting to dupe authorities with false threats and disinformation. Talk about a lack of privacy. And you kind of wonder, you know, are we always being monitored? You look around, there's cameras everywhere. Our phones are oftentimes being monitored. I'm starting to feel more and more that we're really living in a police state. But the real world violence associated with the site has caused some agencies to pay closer attention to conspiratorial and hateful communities online. So I know this is all very depressing, but this is real. And well, its modern roots predate, it's true, the Trump administration by many decades, white nationalism. And this is a quote from the editorial, today's editorial, in the New York Times, the headline, mass shootings are terrorism. So, well, its modern roots predate the Trump administration by many decades. White nationalism has attained a new mainstream legitimacy during Mr. Trump's time in office. And of course, he can continue to blame everybody and everything, and he doesn't have the ability, he hasn't got the empathy, he doesn't have any introspective capabilities to be able to look inside and perhaps ask himself, is there something that I have done? Is there something that I am doing? Is there something that I need to change that can positively impact what has been going on? Pretty, pretty, pretty scary. And discussions of Americans being replaced, and you know, that's the other thing. We hear this so often by immigrants, for example, are a recurring feature. It's a theme on some programs on Fox News. Fox host Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, for example, return to these themes frequently. Democrats, Ms. Ingraham told the viewers last year, want to replace you, the American voters, with newly amnestized citizens, an ever-increasing number of change immigrants, so that if your own life is not in a good place and you are hearing this message over and over and over again on the media, it's not surprising that people are acting out. You know, other quotes, you will not replace us, white nationalists proudly chanted at Charlottesville in 2017. And Mr. Trump himself proclaimed that there were fine people on both sides of that deadly event. And far more Americans have died at the hands of domestic terrorists than at the hands of Islamic extremists in 2001, according to the FBI. The agency's resources, however, are still overwhelmingly weighted toward thwarting international terrorism. So there is a lot that we need to do. And advertisers, they have a duty. You know something? They really have a duty. It's not just about money and the bottom line, not to sponsor television programs that flirt with white nationalism or advocate it outright. Banks have a duty not to help finance white nationalist organizations. Religious leaders should feel called to denounce white nationalism from the pulpit. And technology companies, they too have a responsibility to deplatform white nationalist propaganda and communities as they did ISIS propaganda. And if the technology companies refuse to step up, law enforcement has a duty to vigilantly monitor and end the anonymity via search warrants of those who openly plot attacks in murky forums. And those people who encourage terrorism anonymously online should also be named. And those who sympathize with the white nationalist ideology but who deplore the violence should work closely with law enforcement to see that fellow travelers who may be prone to violence do not have access to firearms like semi-automatic assault-style weapons that are massively destructive. And most importantly in this article, American law enforcement needs to target white nationalists with the same zeal that they have targeted radical Islamic terrorists, ensuring the security of the homeland. And that is something that needs to happen. And there cannot be a middle ground when it comes to white nationalism and the terrorism it inspires. You're either for it or you are against it. And I really wonder whether or not conversations like this are going to be taking place in the schools. The kids know what's going on. There needs to be dialogue. There needs to be education. We need to find a way to come together, whether or not we're conservatives or liberals or progressives, and listen to each other and hear each other. And as Reverend Barber talks, to find a way that we can create a much more moral society. And it's not about not talking to conservatives, and it's not about not talking to people who are white nationalists, but there really does need to be a lot of ongoing dialogue. And I was reading in one of the newspapers that Christian Gillibrand, she was saying that she was able to win by talking to white women who were Trump supporters. We need to have the conversations, because I think that people are really, they're not educated about what is really going on in the world. And if we're listening to the mass media, and if we're listening to Fox, and if we're listening to Trump, and if we don't have another perspective,